listening to 103.1 FM and 980 AM WPFP Park Falls. This is Trail Mix 103.1.
You're listening to Radio Health Journal, the trusted news source for medicine, science, and technology. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
I'm Mayan Vasta Betancourt.
And I'm Greg Johnson. This week, medical school is notoriously intensive, but it wasn't always this way.
If you went to medical school, that degree didn't guarantee any particular robustness in clinical education, let alone laboratory education.
But first, how going to the wrong doctor could increase your chances of being misdiagnosed.
Our primary care physicians are not trained to diagnose psychiatric disorders. They have very little training. It's essentially the equivalent of binging on a couple of seasons of Grey's Anatomy.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
What's better than one win? Three wins? With Straight Savings, you keep your own phone, get one line for only $25 a month with real unlimited data, and get rewarded with a $200 phone credit after 12 months. It's a win-win-win. Head to Walmart or visit straighttalk.com today. Switch to Straight Talk. Less dollars, more sense. Straight Savings Plan enrollment requires compatible unlocked device and new line of service. Bonus device credit requires 12 months of active service. Offer ends if eligibility requirements are no longer met. Taxes and fees apply. For network management practices, see Straight Talk's terms and conditions.
Mom, meet Sarah.
From first time Nana moments.
Yeah, welcome to Flight 101.
To annual girls trip moments. Your can't-miss moments are worth protecting against RSV. If you're 75 or older or 60-plus with a chronic condition like asthma, COPD, heart disease, or severe diabetes, you're at higher risk of landing in the hospital from RSV. And there are no prescription RSV treatments. Check eligibility and schedule your RSV vaccine at VaxAssist.com.
So where should we go next?
Sponsored by Pfizer.
Sarah Faye can track her life by flipping through her medical record. As an adolescent, doctors told Faye that she had anorexia. In her 20s, she was diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder, and later on, major depressive disorder. By the time Faye had entered her 30s, the diagnosis had switched to OCD. However, after a few years, it changed again to ADHD. Oh, and don't forget the bipolar diagnoses, first labeled as bipolar 2 and then swapped out for bipolar 1. Faye's journey through mental illness inspired her book, Pathological: The True Story of 6 Misdiagnoses. Faye began on this journey at age 12. Although she appeared underweight, her anorexia diagnosis didn't take into account the real reason behind her eating habits.
Anorexia is so visible, but my situation was that my parents were divorcing. I was only 12 years old and I was going to a new high school and I was terrified. And I had a terrible, just lurking pit in my stomach. I mean, it felt like a black hole and I didn't want to eat. I couldn't eat. And so is that anorexia is the question, because anorexia, you know, the symptoms of it are obsessively weighing yourself or obsessively being concerned with body image and how you look. I never weighed myself and I wasn't concerned with that. I was a young person. My parents were divorcing and I was going to a new high school. But once I was given the diagnosis, I identified with it. So I was cutting my food up. I learned how to hide my food and make it look like I had eaten more than I had on my plate. And eventually I started to weigh myself and that became obsessive. And I started to think about the way I looked and wanted to have more of that skeletal appearance.
This early teenage experience laid the foundation for Faye to strongly identify with all of her future diagnoses. From then on, Faye embodied each new label doctors gave her.
I identified with each one completely. I mean, I just adopted what they were and what they meant and what it meant to have obsessive compulsive disorder or ADHD or bipolar disorder. And what that looked like was I basically first started to learn what the symptoms were and then started to see those symptoms in myself.
Faye began to pathologize every aspect of her life, blaming any emotion on whatever her diagnosis was at the time.
Once I had a diagnosis and I knew what the symptoms were, so I knew that I was excessively worrying, I immediately saw it as a sign of my anxiety disorder. And then every time I worried, it was a sign, oh yes, I do have this diagnosis. And I never really learned how to process emotion. And I never learned how to relate to my thoughts. Everything was a problem. My behaviors were a problem. And it really became most dangerous once I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I think that that was when it really became my entire identity.
Faye was never diagnosed by a psychologist until her 40s and on her sixth diagnosis. The previous disorders had been identified by a general practitioner.
And actually, primary care physicians give 80% of the prescriptions for antidepressants. So we're really, in some ways, the conversation about psychiatry and diagnoses and the flaws with it automatically goes to psychiatry, and we attack psychiatrists. And in some cases, that's warranted. But I wanted to give the experience that a lot of people are having, which is that you are in a medical facility with a man in a white coat with a stethoscope around his neck, or a woman, or not, but that's who's giving us our diagnoses. We would never question them. I thought they were 100% scientific and valid and reliable and as medically sound as a cancer diagnosis.
The American Academy of Family Physicians says a majority of mental health diagnoses come from primary care physicians. In fact, 2/3 of people with depression are diagnosed and treated by general practitioners. These doctors are able to help patients who may not be able to afford to see a psychologist. However, Faye says many of these physicians aren't equipped with enough knowledge to give a proper mental health diagnosis.
Our primary care physicians are not trained to diagnose psychiatric disorders. They have very little training. It's essentially the equivalent of binging on a couple of seasons of Grey's Anatomy. And they do so in inpatient wards, inpatient treatment programs, so the most severe cases, not in clinical settings with often what's called the worried well. I don't love that term because it belittles, you know, what a lot of the suffering that people have, but it isn't acute suffering and it's not life-threatening suffering. But what we need to do is either let people know that their primary care physicians really aren't necessarily equipped to give you the correct diagnosis so that you don't identify every thought, emotion, and behavior with your diagnosis and over-identify with it.
But even those who are able to see a psychiatrist may not be receiving adequate care. Faye's first experience was with a man she calls Dr. M in her book. Dr. M was her therapist and psychiatrist, but Faye wanted to keep those two separate.
I said I wanted to see someone else for therapy and continue to see him for psychiatry. He said he wouldn't do that. I was too sick for that. And I was out of medications at the time. I didn't have any refills and was very low on medications. And he was very much full of hubris. He was a bipolar expert. He wanted to make sure I knew I was bipolar and wouldn't entertain any other possibilities. So I basically was out of my medications and without a psychiatrist, and my primary care physician had retired, and I was suicidal and in a crisis.
Not knowing what to do, Faye leaned on her family. She calls them the heroes of her story, recognizing the support she's received isn't a given for so many struggling with mental illness. Faye's sister stepped in and found her a new psychiatrist.
We had our initial consultation and it was, you know, 30 minutes. And at the end, I just waited for him to proclaim what diagnosis I had now. And I waited for him to tell me a new diagnosis, you know, or the old diagnosis, something like that. And instead, he looked at me and he said, "I don't know what you have." And my whole world shifted. And I thought, no one knows what I have. None of you do. And then as I was leaving his office and I was walking down the street, I thought, what are all these diagnoses I've been given?
It was at that moment Faye decided she needed to learn everything she could about how mental health disorders are diagnosed. She's now published her research in order to help save others from going down a similar path.
I'm not anti-psychiatry in any way. I'm pro-psychiatry, I'm pro-medication. I'm just anti a lack of transparency about the diagnoses we're receiving. And I think for the most part, even my doctors who did damage in some ways to me meant well.
And though her story is one of growth and knowledge, Faye thinks a better diagnostic system would have saved her years of suffering. She believes her decades of misdiagnoses stem from the one-size-fits-all approach of the American Psychiatric Association. The APA releases a Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or a DSM. It's more popularly known as the Psychiatric Bible. The DSM is used around the world as the standard for diagnosing mental illness, but Faye says it's inherently unreliable.
No DSM diagnosis can distinguish between normal and abnormal. So in most physical diagnoses, you can have a test or an x-ray that tells you, yes, do you see, here's the abnormality on the x-ray, here's the blood count that is off. You know, you can show where abnormal and normal kind of differ, where they depart from each other. And the DSM and our mental health diagnoses don't have that.
The APA just published the most recent edition of the DSM in 2022, nearly 10 years after the previous version.
In 9 years, in almost a decade, they did almost nothing to rectify the mistakes of the DSM-5.
One change the newest DSM did make was lowering the threshold for certain diagnoses. What that means is if the time requirement for diagnosing depression was 6 months, a lowered threshold would make it possible to diagnose the disorder just after 2 weeks. Faye says lowering the diagnostic requirement can create a false epidemic.
So what that means is that basically it seems like the number of people who have social anxiety disorder, or autism, or ADHD is going up exponentially because we're finally finding those people, when in reality, the DSM has been revised and the diagnostic criteria has gotten much easier to diagnose. A real epidemic would be, oh, we finally found all these people with ADHD or OCD or whatever it might be, when in reality, what happened was there was a revision to the DSM and suddenly the diagnostic criteria was much easier to apply to more people. And that's why you have more people with the diagnosis.
A DSM diagnosis requires a patient's self-reported symptoms and a clinician's professional opinion. Oftentimes, the clinician is not a psychiatrist. Faye thinks that's what the DSM fails to take into account.
Sometimes I think, and I don't know this because I'm not in his head, but I think they're thinking of the best clinician out there, right? The smartest, the best educated, with the best knowledge and the most sensibility and the most emotional intelligence. And I do think that my psychiatrist is that guy now, but I had a lot of not those doctors, and primary care physicians are doing most of the diagnosing.
Which can lead to an inaccurate diagnosis, like in Faye's case. She hopes her story empowers patients to ask more questions.
We all really want to talk about mental health, but what we're doing is confusing mental health with mental health diagnoses. Right? So we all have to take care of our mental health. But depression, the emotion, is not depression, the disorder. And anxiety, the emotion, is not anxiety, the disorder. Yet when we talk about or even write about or read about depression or anxiety, let's say as a result of the pandemic, it can in the next breath go to anxiety disorder, depression as a disorder.
Looking past her own story, Faye recognizes that not all doctors get it wrong.
Sometimes when you question diagnoses, it sounds like I'm questioning mental illness, and I'm not. So even though there are flaws in the extreme with the mental health diagnoses we receive, mental illness is very, very real. I had one. I know many people who struggle with them, and I very much identify as someone who had a mental illness. And I think people who struggle with mental illness are some of the strongest people on the planet, and I take great pride in having survived it myself.
You can find more information about Sarah Faye and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Instagram, and X. This segment originally aired May 2022. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
Coming up, the history of medicine in America, when Radio Health Journal returns.
Moments like making my kids my famous meatballs mean a lot to me. But after being diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, or MBC, which is breast cancer that has spread to other parts of the body, they mean even more. I take Ibrance, palbociclib.
Ibrance 125 milligram tablets with an aromatase inhibitor is for adults with HR-positive, HER2-negative MBC as the first hormonal-based therapy. Ask your doctor about Ibrance and visit Ibrance.com. Ibrance may cause low white blood cell counts that may lead to serious infections. Ibrance may cause severe inflammation of the lungs. Both of these can lead to death. Tell your doctor right away if you have new or worsening symptoms, including trouble breathing, shortness of breath, cough, or chest pain. Before taking Ibrance, tell your doctor if you have fever, chills, or other signs of infection, liver or kidney problems, are or plan to become pregnant, or are breastfeeding. Common side effects include low red blood cell and low platelet counts, infections, tiredness, nausea, sore mouth, abnormalities in liver blood tests, diarrhea, hair thinning or loss, vomiting, rash, and loss of appetite.
The term modern medicine is often used to imply superior knowledge and technology to what we had before. Using robots to perform surgeries, for example, seems more evolved than previous methods that weren't nearly as precise. However, Dr. Jeremy Green says we may be too quick to disregard the past practices and achievements of our ancestors. In fact, it's this history that's influenced our current understanding of sickness and health.
We have a problem when we say that medicine became scientific on a given date or a moment in time, or that medicine became modern at some specific juncture, right? So if you look at 18th century medical practitioners in the United States, they understood what they were doing to be modern and in accordance with leading scientific thoughts of the time.
Green is a physician, professor, and director of the Institute of the History of Medicine at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine.
I think that within medicine, many people inhabit a history that, of course, you know, we were just wandering in the wilderness for a while and then suddenly medicine became scientific. Or maybe we can draw a straight line about step one, step two, step three. But I think that the challenge is, as long as there has been medicine and as long as there has been science, there has been such a thing as scientific medicine.
Still, there are a few moments in history that many American historians point to as the scientific revolution. Some controversial claims believe it was the creation of the American Medical Association in 1847. Others hold the germ theory of disease to be the turning point. However, Green argues that there can never really be a specific time in history because the practitioners in every period considered their work to be modern and cutting edge.
The world is different before and after the widespread acceptance of germ theory, for example, which is what a lot of people point to. Or the world is different before and after the widespread adoption of randomized controlled trials for the proof of whether or not a pharmaceutical therapy is effective or not. Each of these periods has its own different thing that could be pointed to about why modern medicine was so much better than that which came before. So we could talk about a number of different inflection points, but no one of them is actually truer than the others.
Despite the controversy, Green agrees that he'd rather be working and receiving care with today's knowledge. Before there were x-rays and antibiotics, America's public health relied mainly on folk and traditional medicine. Traditional medicine centered around the theory of the four humors, which states that a person's health depends on the balance of four bodily fluids: blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. Dr. Kenneth M. Ludmerer is a Mapledorn Reader Distinguished Professor of the History of Medicine at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. He says that this practice was often referred to as heroic medicine because of the intense nature of the treatments.
Physicians would bleed, they would purge, they would apply leeches on as treatments. There was little empirical basis to the work that they did. And if you're looking at 17th, 18th, much of the 19th century, there was significant competition from non-medical healers. This included, particularly in the 19th century, various medical sects such as homeopathy, Thomsonian, water healing, and it also included a lot of faith healing and just a lot of common sense folk medicine.
Bloodletting is a practice that dates all the way back to ancient Egypt. If a person was sick, the physician would draw blood until the illness was gone. It's thought that this method led to the death of America's founding father, George Washington, who had 40% of his blood taken to try and cure his sudden sickness. You may be wondering why physicians continued to use these methods when the outcomes were so varied and the negative side effects could result in the patient's death. Well, Ludmerer says that this was during a time before data was gathered through observation and experiments. Word of mouth was the best advertising, and those who it didn't work on often weren't alive to share their experience.
everyone had a certain number of successes, if for no other reason than most people got well anyway, despite what was done to them, not necessarily because of what treatment they received.
However, this began to change when the numerical method was brought into medicine at the beginning of the 19th century in France. It was the beginning of the controlled clinical trials we have today, which compare the results of a medication or procedure to a group of people that didn't receive the same treatments. It was this method that revealed that many popular therapies didn't work.
But then as time went on and scientific medicine began to yield significant fruit, you could use the same statistical and numerical methods to show that diphtheria antitoxin worked, that fluid therapy worked in certain conditions, that thyroid treatment worked for those who were hypothyroid. And so by the end of the 19th century, it was quite clear that scientific medicine was working.
And though Green argues that medicine and science have always been intertwined, this specific moment in time became the foundation for the modern medical schools we have today. Since we had a new way of testing the efficacy of treatments, we needed a new way to educate physicians that would be rooted in scientific research. It was a huge financial undertaking that was mainly backed by billionaire John Rockefeller, along with a few other philanthropists. In 1893, Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine became America's first modern medical school, heavily relying on lab research and the scientific method. Unfortunately, the quality of education was extremely underwhelming.
If you went to medical school, that degree didn't guarantee any particular robustness in clinical education, let alone laboratory education. Medical students didn't even necessarily need to take a different course in their second year or their third year or their fourth year. They could repeat the same courses. So there was a real problem in the nature of medical education, which Johns Hopkins, on its founding at the very end of the 19th century, set up a curriculum of the first 2 years being laboratory basic science education, the second 2 years being clinically based hospital rotations in an academic teaching hospital.
This new approach to education became the standard in America, but there were still many schools that continued using the old methods. In order to create cohesion between more than 100 medical schools across the nation, the Carnegie Foundation commissioned Abraham Flexner to conduct an independent report of all of America's medical schools that was published in the year 1910. While this report is a pivotal moment in American history for standardizing medical education, it was incredibly damaging for women and people of color in this field. Join us next week as we deep dive into the Flexner Report and the unwilling sacrifices made in the pursuit of medical advancement. You can find out more about Dr. Jeremy Green, Dr. Kenneth Ludmerer, and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our production manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Greg Johnson. This segment is brought to you by the Capital One Venture Card. Earn unlimited 2x miles on every purchase, plus earn unlimited 5x miles on hotels and rental cars booked through Capital One Travel. Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Radio Health Journal returns in just a moment.
Total Wireless is made to totally keep up with you. We now have unlimited data that never slows you down, covered by the Verizon 5G network, and all for less than $30 a month when you get four lines. And the best part? We give you a free Samsung Galaxy A54 5G when you switch to the Total 5G Plus Unlimited plan. Visit your local Total Wireless store today. Total Wireless, we're totally with you. Actual speeds may vary by location. For data management practices, see TotalWireless.com.
Tommy! I can't wait for golf this weekend, huh, buddy? Time flies. Love you, man. Oh, don't forget your knee brace again. We aren't in college anymore.
Moments together matter. So help protect yourself from RSV. If you're 75 or older or 60 plus with a chronic condition like asthma, COPD, heart disease, or severe diabetes, you're at higher risk of landing in the hospital from RSV. And there are no prescription RSV treatments. Check eligibility and schedule your RSV vaccine at VaxAssist.com. Sponsored by Pfizer.
I'm still going for it, even with higher stroke risk from atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem.
Over a 3-year study, Eliquis apixaban tablets reduced stroke risk better than warfarin, and over 97% of Eliquis patients did not experience a stroke. A first stroke occurred in 2.9% of warfarin patients versus 2.3% of Eliquis patients.
Don't stop taking prescription Eliquis without asking your doctor. It may increase your stroke risk. Eliquis can cause serious and, in rare cases, fatal bleeding. Don't take Eliquis if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or take longer for bleeding to stop. A spinal injection while on Eliquis increases risk of blood clots, which may cause paralysis, the inability to move. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding, unusual bruising, or tingling, numbness, or muscle weakness. Medications such as aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners may increase bleeding risk. Tell your doctor about all planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
Medical notes this week. Can listening to music change our past? While it won't allow us to physically go back in time, a new study shows that it can help us change our feelings about previous experiences. Using brain imaging, researchers were able to see how music altered the participants' brain activity. It increased connectivity between the emotional processing part of the brain and other areas associated with memory. The work is published in the journal Cognitive, Affective, and Behavioral Neuroscience. Is bacteria to blame for mental illness? Researchers have noticed a connection between disorders such as schizophrenia and a vector-borne pathogen called Bartonella. In fact, diagnosed patients are 3 times more likely to have DNA from this bacterium in their blood. The study, published in Frontiers in Psychiatry, shows that certain infections may be a potential cause of some psychiatric disorders. And finally, prescription drug abuse is declining in teenagers. A study in JAMA compared teen medical use, abuse, and availability of opioids, stimulants, and benzodiazepines from 2009 and 2022. Lifetime medical use decreased by 8%, and 49% of adolescents now believe it would be impossible to get their hands on prescription drugs for misuse. Researchers believe these numbers stem from school closures during COVID, changes in prescribing practices, and more parental oversight. And that's Medical Notes this week. I'm Mayon Vosta Betancourt.
Total Wireless is made to totally keep up with you. We now have unlimited data that never slows you down, covered by the Verizon 5G network, and all for less than $30 a month when you get 4 lines. And the best part? We give you a free Samsung Galaxy A54 5G when you switch to the Total 5G Plus Unlimited plan. Visit your local Total Wireless store today. Total Wireless, we're totally with you. Actual speeds may vary by location. For data management practices, see TotalWireless.com.
Mom, meet Sarah.
From first-time Nana moments.
Yeah, welcome to Flight 101.
To annual girls' trip moments.
Your can't-miss moments are worth protecting against RSV. If you're 75 or older or 60-plus with a chronic condition like asthma, COPD, heart disease, or severe diabetes, you're at higher risk of landing in the hospital from RSV. And there are no prescription RSV treatments. Check eligibility and schedule your RSV vaccine at VaxAssist.com.
So where should we go next?
Sponsored by Pfizer.
Thank you for joining us this week and every week as we break down the science stories you need to know. You can find all of our past segments and guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and X for daily content. And tune in next week for another edition of Radio Health Journal.
I don't know about other states, but in Wisconsin, we help our neighbors and love our communities. But California mega millionaire Eric Hovde doesn't seem to get that. Maybe that's why he questioned whether children should be able to stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26. And whether people in nursing homes should be able to vote. Hovde called for raising the retirement age for hardworking Wisconsinites and making obese people pay more for health care. And a Hovde company even spent decades trying to demolish the building housing Madison's oldest family-owned bar, something they finally did this year, shuttering a treasured neighborhood institution for good. That is not how we do things in Wisconsin. And that is why we can't let California mega millionaire Eric Hovde represent us.
Paid for by a Better Wisconsin Together Action.
abwt-action.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
At Civic Media, we encourage active political engagement and remind listeners to think critically about political advertisements you may hear during this critical election year. Our stations are licensed by the FCC and are required to accept all ads for federal candidates. We also air state and local candidates, as well as paid ads from issue and PAC groups. Truth is rarely as simple as any political ad may claim. So again, we urge you to think critically about what you hear in the spirit of promoting authentic and respectful civic dialogue.
Have you outgrown your health insurance plan? The number one reason we all change our health insurance is price. Are you paying too much for your health insurance? Would you like to have better coverage at a better rate? Take a few minutes right now and find out if you can save money or even qualify for zero-cost health insurance in your state. Call now.
800-693-9308. 800-693-9308. That's 800-693-9308.
This weather update is sponsored by Hansen HVAC Heating and Cooling, your local Armstrong Air dealer of Phillips and Manitouish Waters.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Tons of sunshine for your Sunday with light east winds developing. Highs in the upper 70s to near 80. Tonight, quite cool. Clear skies, light winds out of the southeast. Lows will drop to the upper 40s to lower 50s. Sunny and breezy Monday. Currently 44 degrees.
This week on Viewpoints.
For some people, it's peanuts. For a different generation, it might be Calvin and Hobbes or The Far Side. For a different generation, it was Blondie or Steve Canyon or Terry and the Pirates.
We delve into the rich history of comics. Then,
you don't have face-to-face contact with other human beings, and so you forget how to even make normal facial expressions.
The permanent damage caused by living in solitary confinement for weeks on end. I'm Marty Peterson.
And I'm Gary Price. These stories in depth this week on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.
Total Wireless is made to totally keep up with you. We now have unlimited data that never slows you down, covered by the Verizon 5G network, and all for less than $30 a month when you get four lines. And the best part, we give you a free Samsung Galaxy A54 5G when you switch to the Total 5G Plus Unlimited plan. Visit your local Total Wireless store today. Total Wireless, we're totally with you.
Actual speeds may vary by location. For data management practices, see TotalWireless.com.
Mom, meet Sarah.
From first time Nana moments.
Yeah, welcome to Flight 101.
To annual girls trip moments.
Your can't-miss moments are worth protecting against RSV.
If you're 75 or older or 60-plus with a chronic condition like asthma, COPD, heart disease, or severe diabetes, you're at higher risk of landing in the hospital from RSV. And there are no prescription RSV treatments. Check eligibility and schedule your RSV vaccine at vaxassist.com.
So where should we go next?
Sponsored by Pfizer.
From Archie to Calvin and Hobbes to Batman, comics are an American staple. Whether it's a short comic strip or comic book series, these visual storylines pull you in and make you feel like you're in a different time and place. They're easy to read and follow, and there's a comic out there for everyone. If you're an adult listening, you probably have fond memories of flipping through the colorful pages of a comic you used to love.
Almost everybody I've talked to has some kind of childhood, strongly forged connection to comics. It could be, for everybody, it's different, right? For some people, it could be Spider-Man. For other people, it could be Little Lulu. For other people, it could be Archie or Richie Rich. For younger people now, it could be the graphic novels of someone like Raina Telgemeier. But everybody has this extremely strong and visceral memory of saying, I saw this words and pictures, these comics put together, and it stuck with me, and it's been formative in my experiences and in my life, even just as a strongly remembered emotional moment.
That's Jeremy Dauber, a professor of Jewish literature and American studies at Columbia University. He's also the author of the book American Comics, A History. He says that comics are so pervasive in American culture because the illustrated storylines appeal to everyone in one way or another.
This was part of a lot of Americans, kids, grown-ups, daily routine was they had some comic, right? They picked up the newspaper in the morning, right? They read the comics, right? This was part of who they were. And it wasn't surprising that the strips developed to address and think about all sorts of concerns and issues and emotions and feelings that people had in their everyday lives. It really was a reflection and remains a reflection of who people are. And that is something that makes it so magical.
So how did this unique art form of combining pictures and words together come about? Dauber says that world historians don't have a definitive answer about when comics first began, but in the U.S., the first prototype was seen as early as the colonial period. It started off small, slowly gaining traction and gained larger popularity around the time of the Civil War.
That's really when people are beginning to get these cartoons and comics in their weekly reading and their weekly enjoyment in a way that really crosses the entire country. And it really takes off around the end of the 19th century with the rise of newspaper chains and syndicates and newspaper titans who want something that's going to really bring readers in, something exciting and visually stimulating that's going to bring readers in. And comics was the answer for that. So that's really when our story takes off.
One of the most influential people of this time was Thomas Nast. The German-born editorial cartoonist is recognized today as the father of the American cartoon. He's famous for the creation of Uncle Sam and his bold, political-driven cartoons that exposed widespread greed and corruption and poked fun at the powerful.
Nast was brilliant at the art of cartooning, not only because of the careful draftsmanship and his capability of sort of getting a scene down in this visual imagery, right? This is when photography is still very much in its infancy. And so, you know, you have these drawings that really tell it. But also, he's capable of creating these incredibly impactful symbols, these icons of cartooning that really sort of say a lot in a single kind of image.
While Nast is best known for his political cartoons, surprisingly enough, he's also responsible for the classic image of Santa Claus. He first drew Santa Claus in January 1863 in the magazine Harper's Weekly, giving the character a long beard and rounded belly. Dauber says that at the time, these characters were often used to spread pro-Union propaganda.
He was also writing and drawing these cartoons that created a kind of sympathy for the Union at the time of the Civil War, because he just was able to put symbolic material and sort of representation in one sort of incredibly powerful package. And comics can do that at their best.
Thomas Nast stayed a key figure in the creation of American cartoons until his death in 1902. By then, comics had really taken off as people in rapidly expanding urban areas relied more on newspapers for information.
These newspaper titans, people like Joseph Pulitzer or William Randolph Hearst, they really wanted to bring as many people to their newspapers as possible, of course. And so they realized that comics, which had wonderful pictures, very sort of attractive. They could be attractive to little kids who could convince their parents to buy a favorite paper. They were good for people whose English might not have been quite so strong, so that they weren't have to reading so much of the text-heavy aspects of the newspapers. These were great circulation leaders. And so people like Pulitzer and Hearst started using increasingly technologically advanced printing presses to publish comics that had really interesting stories, very funny moments, were wonderfully drawn, and that would say, I want the paper with the Cats and Jammer kids in it, or the Yellow Kid in it, or Blondie in it, as time went on.
The popularity of these cartoons stayed constant throughout the 20th century. Illustrated stories broke up the imposing walls of text in newspapers and drew a more diverse audience. As a result, some comics gained such a following that they moved to a serial format that would continue the storyline from one day to the next.
There's a very old statement that you're not selling today's paper. They already have today's paper. What you're selling is tomorrow's paper. So a comic was great for this because it said, okay, well, I got to tune in tomorrow to see what the next installation of the story is going to be.
Dauber says that some of these already published serial comic strips were later reprinted and turned into the earliest comic books. From there, comic books also became a birthplace of new stories as superheroes like Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman came to life in the late 1930s and early 40s. Fast forward a couple decades, and the age of superheroes really took off with influential people like comic book writer Stan Lee driving storylines.
It starts with kind of the revamping of some of those old, what we call golden age superheroes, like the Flash and Green Lantern. But very soon after that, there comes a new revitalization of the superhero genre with what comes out of what we now know as Marvel Comics, right? And it is pretty fair to say that the energy of that new revitalization comes from the partnership of two or three people. One of them is Stan Lee, one of them is a guy named Jack Kirby, and one of them is a guy named Steve Ditko. And between the three of them, they have come up with a lot of the people who we're seeing all over sort of the movie screens today.
Characters like Spider-Man, the Hulk, and Doctor Strange still persist today because they're relatable and exciting. Dauber says that narratives where these characters have love trouble or can't make rent add another layer of reality to the mix.
These kind of concerns made them much more appealing to a slightly older audience, including a college audience, which at that point was quite rare for these kind of mainstream superhero comics. And that really kickstarted a new wave in thinking about what this kind of comic book could do.
Today, the field of comics looks a lot different. Comic strip characters like Garfield and Peanuts have turned into TV and film adaptations. Superheroes first seen in comic books are now part of a multi-billion dollar industry. Even physical comic book publishing has moved online, allowing more creators to take part. The concept and creativity behind comics is quite unlike anything else. And similar to any other industry, it's always changing. To find out more about our guest, Jeremy Dauber, visit viewpointsradio.org. You can find his book, American Comics, A History, available online and in bookstores now. This segment was written and produced by Amira Zavari. Studio production by Jason Dickey. I'm Gary Price.
Coming up, more than a quarter to a third of prisoners serving their sentence end up in solitary confinement. We examine this long-held practice of forced isolation when Viewpoints returns.
Febreze. Fabric Talk.
Hey, it's me, your couch. Today's my favorite day of the week, Febreze Fabric Spray Day. The occasional deep cleans are nice, but in between, you know I'm needing a refresh. Ooh, here she comes with the Febreze Fabric Spray. Oh, yeah, spritz them armrests. Don't be shy. Nothing like a good spray down to get me smelling so fresh and clean. Don't forget my back. Nice. Febreze Fabric Spray. It's just that easy. Now we can both breathe happy. Febreze. La, 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 la.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds, which could be life-changing. I mean, you could put that money towards concert tickets for your daughter to see that singer who sings about painful breakups. And one song will inspire your little beauty to break up with that beast she's dating, Brian. Instead, she'll date someone who's nice and worthy of her love, not someone who addresses you and your spouse as bro. And it's all because you could save money switching at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states.
Tommy! I can't wait for golf this weekend, huh, buddy? Time flies. Love you, man. Oh, don't forget your knee brace again. We aren't in college anymore.
Moments together matter. So help protect yourself from RSV. If you're 75 or older or 60 plus with a chronic condition like asthma, COPD, heart disease, or severe diabetes, you're at higher risk of landing in the hospital from RSV. And there are no prescription RSV treatments. Check eligibility and schedule your RSV vaccine at VaxAssist.com. Sponsored by Pfizer.
Good morning, doctor.
Doctor.
Hi, doctor.
Doctor?
Dr. Jackson's practice is growing.
What do you mean we're still short-staffed?
He needs a good patient doctor.
How do we not have enough doctors to doctor all these patients?
And he doesn't have the patience to sift through hundreds of resumes.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. When you sponsor a job on Indeed, it's easier for talented candidates to find it, which makes it easier for you to hire them. Visit Indeed.com/credit and get $75 towards your first sponsored job. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine spending day in and day out in a 6x8-foot room with no windows and blank white walls. There's overhead fluorescent lighting, a bare sleeping cot, and a steel toilet. The most stimulation you get on an average day is when a tray of food is pushed through a slotted opening. There's no clock on the wall, so you lose all sense of time. And there's no one to talk to, so you begin to talk to yourself. This is the reality for tens of thousands of prisoners in the U.S. on any given day.
Often, people talk about it being eerily quiet, or else you hear echoing sounds, like a door sliding open really echoes. You can imagine it's like, in some ways, it's like walking into an empty building. There's no carpets. There's no paintings. Most often, there's no natural light, maybe sometimes a tiny slit of a window.
That's Dr. Keramet Ryder, a professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at the University of California, Irvine. She says that inmates are usually put in isolation because they're deemed to be uncooperative, violent, mentally ill, or need protection from other prisoners. Jump back to the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, and up to 300,000 prisoners were placed in confinement for months to stop the spread of the virus.
While I think we were making immense progress pre-pandemic with reducing the use of these conditions, there's a national stop solitary movement. There has been legislation, litigation, administrative decisions from within prisons to reduce the length of time people spend in these conditions and the number of people in these conditions. All the facilities still existed, and they were a natural place to isolate people when COVID outbreaks happened. And so the thing I've heard the most is that in prisons, people were afraid to say when they started feeling bad or they had an exposure because they knew the most likely outcome was they were going to be placed in solitary confinement indefinitely.
Experts estimate that today, around a quarter to a third of prisoners cycle through solitary confinement during some portion of their sentence. About 8% of prisoners are in solitary at any given time, according to the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Some spend years locked up in this harsh environment for minor infractions.
There's a growing body of evidence that after even a few days in these conditions, even from experiments in the 70s around military trainings, that sensory deprivation can cause people to hallucinate, have real sleep disturbances, have intense anxiety and heart palpitations within even a few days. And these conditions, right, when we're talking about no access to natural light, fluorescent lights that are on 24 hours a day, no human contact for extended periods, these are very similar to sensory deprivation conditions. And in studies people have done, rates of suicide and self-harm in these units are often twice as high or higher than in the general prison population, where, of course, they're higher than in the general population of the country also.
Even after prisoners are released from solitary, the research has shown that it's led to lasting and severe damage. Paranoia, depression, heart damage, and a loss of social skills and identity are just some of the issues that have been previously reported. It's been well studied that the majority of inmates head into jail with mental health problems, and now it's only exacerbated. Tracy Velasquez manages public safety research for the Pew Charitable Trust and is an expert on criminal justice systems and practices.
What we've seen is that in terms of arrests, about one in four people who was arrested in the past year, according to the National Survey of Drug Use and Health, about a quarter of those people who were arrested had a mental health issue. They had either a serious or moderate mental illness. And we see this figure sort of go forward into jails as well. Other research by the Bureau of Justice Statistics also says about a quarter, about 26% of people in jails met the threshold for being considered having a serious psychological distress issue.
Velasquez says that prisons are legally required to provide mental health care. However, the quality of these programs widely varies from state to state. Some facilities have a large array of resources, while the rest are severely lacking. Ryder says that for inmates in solitary confinement, mental health treatment can often be unhelpful and uncomfortable.
If you develop some kind of psychological symptoms while you are in these conditions, there's often little recourse to get you out. So people might not even be getting enough care to know. And most often the way mental health treatment is provided in these units is someone, not usually a doctor, someone like a nursing technician with a little bit of mental health training, just stops by the front of each cell door on the unit and kind of taps on the little tiny window and says, hey, how are you doing? That means that the person on the cell on either side of you and above and below you can hear everything about that conversation. And so people in solitary confinement describe that as a pretty hard way. That's how you would initiate any kind of need for mental health care. And people describe that as being pretty hard to want to do that in that kind of public environment.
Outside of healthcare workers, many correctional officers who interact with these inmates on a daily basis get little training or direction on how to adequately handle mental health situations.
Generally, in the United States, correctional officers have a few weeks of training at best before they become correctional officers and start walking the cell blocks. And one of the things that struck me spending time in these units is there's often people there who have been so difficult to deal with that they've been sent from forensic hospitals and mental institutions into the state, into the prison system. And then, so you've basically got doctors and nurses who've said, we can't handle these people, and then you send them into a supermax or a solitary confinement unit with correctional officers who've had a few weeks of training and say, you deal with them. And of course, that's frustrating and leads to trouble.
Ryder argues that there must be other alternatives to solitary confinement. Mentally ill or challenging populations shouldn't be automatically thrown into these cells and forgotten for weeks, months, or years. And what happens after a person's done serving their sentence? How are they expected to become functioning members of society when they've spent 22 to 24 hours a day locked up in a box? The Bureau of Prisons, which manages federal prisons, has admitted that solitary confinement isn't an effective deterrent for bad behavior. They've also agreed that it can increase future misconduct. Yet despite this, policies still excessively rely on this inhumane form of punishment. As prison population numbers tick back up, the future remains uncertain for the 1.2 million behind bars. To learn more about solitary confinement and our guests, Dr. Keramit Ryder and Tracy Velasquez, visit viewpointsradio.org. This segment originally aired in November 2021 and was written and produced by Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Marty Peterson. This segment is brought to you by the Capital One Venture X Card. Earn unlimited 2X miles on everything you buy. Plus, get access to over 1,300 airport lounges and a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment.
Whether you own a local business or a global one, you know that these days, generating growth is a challenge. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll not just stay ahead of the curve, you'll move it. With access to experts, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter, locally and globally. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Copyright 2024 Bank of America N.A.
John Legend here. How do I keep my protection against COVID-19 up to date? With a COVID shot this season.
You can get your COVID-19 shot when getting your flu shot if you're due for both, as recommended by the CDC. Ask your healthcare provider and book at vaxassist.com.
Sponsored by Pfizer.
Viewpoints Radio Podcast.
In 1990, only 3% of people in the U.S. said that they don't have any close friends. In 2021, that number had jumped up to 12%.
Listen today by searching Viewpoints Radio wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Viewpoints Explained. I'm Ebony McMorris. Are dating apps out? For the last 10 plus years, people have downloaded apps like Tinder, Bumble, and Hinge to meet other singles and hopefully find love. Go back to 2009, and Grindr was the first dating app to launch and help gay men match with other singles nearby. In 2012, Tinder, an online dating app catered to both men and women, joined the space. It quickly gained traction, and soon singles all over the U.S. were hooked on swiping, hoping to find that potential match. Fast forward to today, and some believe that dating apps are past their prime. Users are fed up and burnt out with the monotonous cycle of swiping, messaging, and suffering through lackluster dates. Many people also feel that the apps just aren't as good as they used to be. The algorithms are more selective, and most platforms are always pushing users to upgrade from a free to a paid subscription. These benefits include more matches and boosted visibility in front of accounts that typically get a lot of attention. Many relationship experts also argue that these apps, filled with endless profiles, have led to a culture of indecisiveness. Some people may feel like there's always someone better out there, so why settle? In this confusing dating landscape, what's the best option out there right now? There's no one answer, but some singles are deleting their online profiles to try and forge meaningful connections in real life. This could mean attending speed dating events, saying yes to that blind date set up by a mutual friend, or striking up a conversation at the bar. Everyone's story looks a little different. Who knows? Maybe a few years from now, dating apps will be back in their golden era. That's Viewpoints Explained for this week. More in a moment.
Welcome to Culture Crash, where we examine what's new and old in entertainment. By all accounts, the production to make Jeremy Saulnier's new film Rebel Ridge was about as perilous as they come. The film originally starred John Boyega and was set to begin filming in April 2020, but production was halted before it began due to the COVID pandemic. In the summer of 2021, the movie finally began filming. But after several weeks, shooting was again halted when Boyega exited the film. Finally, in 2022, the movie was shot to completion with actor Aaron Pierre in to replace Boyega. The point in rehashing all of that is just to say that no one would have been surprised if Rebel Ridge ended up being a dud. Despite Saulnier's tremendous track record of success, having written and directed acclaimed films like Blue Ruin and Green Room, doubts do begin to form when a movie has to start and stop production multiple times. And yet, when the movie was finally released on Netflix on September 6th of this year, it was instantly a hit, both with Netflix users and critics alike. And the reason is simple. Rebel Ridge is great, and Aaron Pierre feels like the absolute perfect leading man. The movie centers on a former Marine who is unjustly detained by the police and has $36,000 taken from him via civil forfeiture. The film follows as Terry, its protagonist, tries to operate within the bureaucratic structures that be to get his money back and bail his cousin out of jail. As is often the case in the movies, red tape and small-town politics prove to be almost impossible hurdles to overcome, and Terry opts to take matters into his own hands. At once a tense thriller and a compelling action movie, Rebel Ridge is a Netflix film that really makes audiences think and consider the world. It tackles real issues like civil forfeiture without ever becoming a biased movie that wears its politics too much on its sleeve. It's nuanced and frustrating, and a movie that uses absolute restraint to bring audience members along for a very tense ride. Against the odds, Jeremy Saulnier was able to withstand multiple production pauses to make Rebel Ridge one of the best movies of the year so far, and it's now streaming on Netflix. I'm Evan Rook.
Total Wireless is made to totally keep up with you. We now have unlimited data that never slows you down, covered by the Verizon 5G network, and all for less than $30 a month when you get four lines. And the best part? We give you a free Samsung Galaxy A54 5G when you switch to the Total 5G Plus Unlimited plan. Visit your local Total Wireless store today. Total Wireless, we're totally with you. Actual speeds may vary by location. For data management practices, see totalwireless.com.
Mom, meet Sarah.
From First Time Nana Moments.
Yeah, welcome to Flight 101.
To annual girls trip moments. Your can't-miss moments are worth protecting against RSV. If you're 75 or older or 60-plus with a chronic condition like asthma, COPD, heart disease, or severe diabetes, you're at higher risk of landing in the hospital from RSV. And there are no prescription RSV treatments. Check eligibility and schedule your RSV vaccine at vaxassist.com.
So where should we go next?
Sponsored by Pfizer.
And that's Viewpoints for this week. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming shows and find a library of past programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and more information about our guests at viewpointsradio.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Viewpoints.
You're listening
listening to 103.1 FM and 980 AM WPFP Park Falls. This is Trail Mix 103.1.